it's a film about a psychiatrist with horrible boundaries. I mean, like, basically, that's like, this man should be disbarred.
This is the Gospel of Musical Theater, a priestly look at some of your favorite musicals, with your hosts, cathedral deans and musical theater queens, Nathan LaRude and Peter Elliott.
This is the Gospel of Musical Theater. I'm Peter.
I'm Nathan.
Hey, Nathan.
Yeah.
Do you believe in ESP?
Do I believe in extrasensory perception? I mean, what a complicated... I've been looking forward to this conversation with you. I don't know that we've ever really explored in each other the depths of our weirder, more esoteric, new agey belief systems.
It's true. It's true.
But I, you know, there's a piece of me that wants to say, no, I don't. I don't believe in extrasensory perception in the way, certainly not in the dumb, gimmicky way that On a Clear Day You Can See Forever presents it to. Like, I don't believe that people can make flowers grow in like 5 minutes. I've never seen that. Barbara Streisand does tell an interesting story in the autobiography about through the power of mind changing the color of her mums. So she does believe in it in ways that are pretty consistent with the way that it's explored in the film. My understanding is that people who actually do believe in ESP don't necessarily recognize it the way that it's being presented in On a Clear Day You Can See Forever. And that's where I would say, you know, extrasensory perception is probably right next door to a lot of what I would consider legitimate religious experience in the Christian framework. Yes. So in the broadest sense, that there is more in heaven and earth than is dreamt of in our philosophy, Horatio, as Hamlet says to Horatio, yes, I believe that there's a lot more that cannot be accounted for through the principles of, you know, traditional science. And some of what passes for sort of New Age theosophy strikes me as a little odd.
I know. There's a really interesting article that I found while we were getting ready for this podcast, an Atlantic interview with Alan J. Lerner just after the Broadway musical was up, where he defined extrasensory perception, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but as beyond what we experience with the five senses. So anything beyond the five senses is extrasensory. And if that's the definition, yeah.
Right. That's a pretty broad definition.
Yeah, it's pretty. I found a quote from Frederick Buechner, Presbyterian, theologian, novelist, who said, talking about coincidence, he said, I won't read the whole thing, "I believe that people laugh at coincidence as a way of relegating it to the realm of the absurd and therefore not having to take seriously the possibility that there's a lot more going on in our lives than we either know or care to know." He said, "I suspect that every now and so often, coincidence is like we hear a whisper from the wings that goes something like this. You've turned up in the right place at the right time. You're doing fine. Don't think you've been forgotten." Now, that is a more theological, personal God way of saying that these intuitions, which Carl Jung would call them, meaningful coincidences, synchronicities, somehow belong to a benign, benevolent deity.
Yeah. Which so quickly then turns into the kind of the version of pop Christianity that's like, God's got a plan for your life.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I mean, this is, so at a certain level, that turns into the puppeteer God, right?
Yeah.
Like the guy who's up there kind of pulling the strings, which I can either then be in fear of, or, which I think is where most kind of religious systems go, try to manipulate that God, appease that God, keep him on my side. And to a certain degree, it's like a lot of the Psalms do open the doorway for that kind of a relationship with God, right? Like, you know, please hear me when I call to you, O God. Like, you know, rout my enemies, smash the heads of the babies against the rocks if they're trying to come for me. Like, why am I so put upon? Please fix this. And so at one level, like the level of human psychology, I recognize, right? Like, of course, things matter to us. We have strong emotional reactions, and it makes sense to take those things to God in prayer. I believe in prayer in that sense, right? I believe that prayer is not just empty words thrown into a nihilistic universe. But there is a for me there's a lot of room between, yes, prayer is a real thing, and God is a puppeteer up there, energy is up there, pulling strings, and the universe has a kind of magical quality to it that can be manipulated, that does strike me as potentially a weird way to be in the world, and potentially a very narcissistic way to be in the world.
Narcissism is a really good word to bring in here. And so I look at On a Clear Day You Can See Forever as kind of a cultural artifact of the mid-1960s, a time which I remember there was a celebrated case about a woman in Wisconsin, I think, who was hypnotized.
Yeah, you went down a rabbit hole.
Oh,
Bridie,
I've been down.
Bridie
Murphy.
I'd never heard of this.
Yeah,
Bridie Murphy.
Yeah. Hypnotized by a friend. He was a management consultant or something, playing around with hypnosis. He did some regression, and it turned out she had this elaborate story that unfolded that she was, and spoke in an Irish brogue. She was a 19th century maid or something like that. It got made into a movie. It was a novel. It was disputed, although she maintained till the end of her life that it was not a psychological fantasy, that this was actually real.
There were regression.
And yeah. Back to in the article that Alan J. Lerner in the Atlantic, he said thousands of people, speaking in about 1965, 66, do this past life regression work all the time. And it was very in vogue. ESP, past life regression, hypnosis as a kind of theater of the mind used both for entertainment and in some psychology. And so I think in that way, what Lerner and Lane, Burton Lane now, not
Lerner and Lane,
not Fritz Lowe anymore. Burton Lane, who wrote Finian's Rainbow, which we've taught and talked about.
Which we've destroyed for other people.
They put together this show for Broadway, which ran only under 300 performances. It didn't do particularly well. That took all these ideas, hypnosis, extrasensory perception, past life regression, and turned it into a love story, really. Unrequited.
Yes. Well, yeah, unrequited from Dr. Chabot's...
Yes.
Right, yeah. Dr. Chabot falls in love with Melinda. I suppose that is the love story here.
He falls in love, for those of you who don't know anything about this thing.
Yeah, give it... No one who listening to this should run out and watch this film. It's not worth your time.
It's not
Peter
worth
and I have done
time.
It for you. It's not a good movie.
No.
I like Barbara. I like Vincent Minnelli. I mean, young Jack Nicholson before he's done a thing.
Bob
so
Newhart.
Bob Newhart. Like, I mean, yeah, the people involved in this thing, it should be a lot better than
Yves Montand,
Yves Montand! Like,
I know.
All of them are, yeah, like, it's a great cast. It's a good create. It's just... It's not good. It's not a good movie.
It's not a good movie. Charles Champlin in the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, excuse me, called the film just about as good as it could be, yet dull. He said, nothing to get mad about, nothing to dislike, just nothing to care about, to put your arm around your sweetheart about, nothing to get so enthused about that you forget there's a smoggy and war-infested world outside. He was talking about 1970.
Yeah.
He could say those words today.
Well, and there is a way in which it does feel like it's trying to do 1962. I mean, even the way that she shows up, Barbra Streisand shows up with her beehive hair and her little Peter Pan collar. She's the nebbishy Brooklyn girlfriend, right? With her kind of knock-kneed. I think she's meant to be like 22. She comes across as like 15. And she looks like she's trying to ape her early television specials from 1962 and 63. And the whole film looks like Meet Me in St. Louis. Except Meet Me in St. Louis was like, you know, like, that's Vincent Minnelli doing it in the time when it's Gigi. He's doing Gigi again. He's an amazing filmmaker. But this is 1970. Like, the world is falling apart.
Right.
Bright colors and flowers are no longer going to cut it.
Right. Right. And Barbara, so let me just summarize the plot.
Yeah, do the plot. That's where this began.
Daisy, who talks to flowers and they grow, I mean, come on, really?
She talks to the trees. I guess, and they listen to her.
I guess you could have called her Rose, but why not Daisy, the flower talking woman? She goes to a university psychology lecture. It's on hypnosis. The professor is hypnotizing somebody on stage. Daisy, played by Barbara Streisand in the film, inadvertently is hypnotized, goes through all the same things he does. She's embarrassed, but she is a chain smoker, 3 or 4 packs a day.
Five packs a day.
Yeah. She's going to be married to a business guy. She's going to a dinner. He wants her to clean up her act. So she asks if the psychologist would hypnotize her so she'll stop smoking. He does. While he's in there, he starts to poke around, discovers that she has a rich past life as a British woman from the 19th century.
A courtesan
whose name is Melinda. Yeah. The Dr. Chabot, played by Yves Montand, falls in love not with Daisy, but with her past life regression person. Daisy, meanwhile, falls in love with the psychologist.
Or develops feelings for him.
That's fair enough.
She has, her boyfriend is kind of a piece of work, and it's not really clear what is supposed to be going on in her
love
life.
And it all doesn't end up well. It all doesn't end up well. And is that a good enough plot summary?
Yeah. One way of looking about it is it's a film about a psychiatrist with horrible boundaries. I mean, like, basically, that's like, this man should be disbarred. He's like, oh my gosh. And so many times and to a certain, I guess this is a good, it's a good reminder that the world of 1970 is a different world. And to a certain degree, it's like, is this just Henry Higgins again? I mean, I feel like Alan J. Lerner really has a fixation for the older, usually, European doctor figure who's kind of a misogynist and lets these men get away with shenanigans that they should be put in jail for. It's heinous what he does to her. I mean, and it's kind of presented for laughs. It's kind of presented for the gag. It's like, are we meant to take him seriously? I don't know. It's like, I don't need to press on that too hard. But yeah, the way that he rummages around in her mind, she'll come for a session and be like, oh, well, I don't really feel like a session today, but I'll take you to dinner. It's like, I would lose my job. My job.
Yeah.
It's astounding the kind of shit he gets away
with. It's a cultural artifact of the 1960s. Yes. So you mentioned My Fair Lady. I think the other thing that Alan J. Lerner is channeling is Brigadoon. This is the discovery of a magical world that exists in Brigadoon. It's a fantasy world that kind of comes to life once every 100 years. For Daisy, it is an interior world that lives within her. So it's kind of the same.
Yes.
It's got a similar theme.
Although in Brigadoon, Alan J. Lerner is not right. Like, it's a fantasy. It's a romance. He doesn't actually believe that there is such a thing as a Scottish town that only comes. That's clearly out of the realm of fantasy. Alan J. Lerner, though, actually does believe in ESP and hypnosis and past life regression. I mean, like, and so there is a way in which On a Clear Day, You Can See Forever is meant to be taken seriously as a depiction of the way, I guess, if nothing else, the way Alan J. Lerner thinks the world works. Now, you and I have talked a little bit about Alan J. Lerner on this podcast before. I'll refer some of our newer listeners to our Lerner and Low season, which actually I went back and listened to a little bit of last night. And actually, it's some of our favorite conversations. I had forgotten that, like, we talk about Gigi, a film that I think I've still not yet convinced you to watch. Have you still not seen it?
I can't. Yeah. I just can't.
I know you can't. And I, here again, I'm not necessarily advocating that anybody go out and see Gigi. It is a fascinating film about sexual mores. And you and I have had some really interesting conversations about Alan J. Lerner because he does, Camelot, I kind of want to say, is the earliest depiction in the musical theater canon that I can think of polyamory. It's a very interesting show about a polyamorous marriage at the heart of it. He's got a really interesting aesthetic. He's a pretty clever lyricist. He's a smart man.
Yeah.
Barbara kind of talks about, it's like kind of enjoying, by the time she's working with him on a Clear Day, he's nearing the end of his life. And she said he was fun. He was avuncular. It sounds like they really kind of got along. Burton Lane was, I think, kind of a weird kind of introvert. She never connected with him. But she liked Alan J. Lerner. She responded to him. I think he had a lot of charm. Famously married 8 times.
Eight times.
So,
one of his wives said, getting married, for Alan J. Lerner, marriage was his way of beginning to say goodbye. It's,
And some of that really comes through in the male character. I mean, the other thing we've talked a lot, I mean, Alan J. Lerner specializes in songs about male loneliness.
Yes.
A lot of his material is about the fundamental loneliness of men. And I think some of that we pick up in Chabot a little bit. But there's this great quote at the end of the Atlantic article about extrasensory perception, right? He said, most people, I've noticed every time the subject of extrasensory perception comes up, people start off by ridiculing it, but end up by saying, you know, I had a funny experience.
Yes.
And then he pivots, right? And then you hear Alan J. Lerner, the misogynist. He says, women, of course, are much more interested in it than men. First of all, they're more subjective. Men dream in different ways. Woman dreams very practically. After all, she creates. We have to prove ourselves. The whole sex has to prove itself all the time. That's the reason we're the artists and have been up until recently. Women have never had to. So throughout the ages, most of the clairvoyants and the extrasensory people have been women. Maybe it indicates their disappointment in us men, because every time I see a woman going to a fortune teller, I know she's got an unhappy something in her life, and she wants to see a sign that it's going to get better. Now, at one level, this is just Alan J. Lerner holding court and rambling.
Oh, boy.
I mean, the whole article is like this, right? I mean, like, it's basically just a monologue. There's a piece of me that's like, I see why he was married. Can you imagine being married to this asshole?
I know.
Like, can you imagine having to endure that at dinner every night? Like, and at another level, it's like, the guy is, I mean, you know, he's interesting. He's kind of smart. He sees the world in a really interesting way. So, like, there's a part of me that wants to take On a Clear Day You Can See Forever, at least in terms of the way it's presenting human psychology, and we might say theology, yeah, right? Like, this is really kind of doing philosophy and theology in a certain kind of way. I want to take him seriously, because I think he's an interesting, smart, creative guy. And there's also a piece of me that's like, the dude is horrifying.
Yeah. About the film, this is about the most sexist film I've ever seen. This is a pre-feminist screed about male-female roles. Daisy is depicted as kind of an airhead, if I can, you know, she's scatterbrained, she doesn't know where things are, but crazily intuitive. She knows when the phone is going to ring before it rings. She makes the flowers grow. She knows what people are going to say. And Alan J. Lerner, I think, is fascinated or projects the intuitive part of the human animal onto women. That men, it's very binary. The men are in charge. The women are, I mean, outside of Daisy, you don't get a lot of strong characters, female characters.
Melinda is kind of an interesting character. Melinda is charismatic, sexually provocative,
right.
Smart. She, you know, grew up in the gutter and has made, you know, kind of clawed her way to the top. I mean, all of her life is sketched for us in very, apparently she's on trial for some sort of, like, treasonous act.
I
all
got
of that
confused
is complete,
at
like,
that part. What
the
was
whole,
going
at that point,
on?
The plot just falls apart. It, like, the whole past life regression thing is like, what the fuck is going on? Like, no one. I think it's just an excuse to put Barbara Streisand in Cecil Beaton gowns.
And the Cecil Beaton gowns are amazing.
She looks
fabulous. In fact, when you're in, because you, the filmmaker depicts Vincent Minnelli and the plot goes into her interior life, so you see it. And those scenes, Vincent Minnelli is now in his element when he's filming in the is it 19th century? Is it 18th century?
Yeah,
is it 17th century?
There's a lot of Empire waists, which is her. That's her look. They film in Brighton Pavilion.
It was the last picture that Cecil Beaton worked on doing costumes. Yeah, and the costumes are fabulous.
They're fabulous.
They're absolutely
especially her gowns.
Fabulous.
They really are. You watch it for the gowns, not for the musical.
Right. And the musical, just to say a word about the songs, the film radically pulled back the number of songs. There are 10 on the soundtrack. Three of them are the title song.
Right.
Because
right.
It's her pride. So
it's really the only song. It's the only song that I really had ever heard before from the show.
Yeah.
I don't think I know any. What did I have that I don't have? It's a great song. And you knew the Frank Sinatra cover of Come Back to Me,
yeah,
which in some ways is, I mean, the creepiest moment in the whole movie is when she's, you know, like, it's kind of the 11 o'clock number, I suppose. The Daisy Gamble character has, like, figured out that this guy is, I mean, this is how bad it gets, right? Like, he has publicized, hey, I've managed to regress this young Brooklyn, I mean, it's nothing but contempt for the Daisy Gamble, this young Brooklyn airhead, and she, you know, so he's publishing, it becomes a phenomenon, he's threatened to lose his job, and she hears about it on the radio, and she puts two and two together and realizes, oh, it's me.
Yeah.
Like, I am his guinea pig. And so, like, flees, right? Like, she runs, realizing appropriately, I am being gaslit, manipulated, and mentally raped by my psychiatrist, and he's publishing about it. He's telling the media about it. And so he gets into her mind and sings the kind of a fun, bouncy Frank Sinatra number and basically, like, reels her back in. I mean, it's sending a chill up my spine even as I'm talking about
yeah.
it. It's horrific. The and it's kind of presented as like this fun, like, hey, baby, like, you know, come back. It's, oh, God, the whole thing just is kind of disgusting to me. It's a great song. It's a great song.
Where in hell can you be? In a crate, in a trunk, on a horse, on a drunk, in a rose or a band. Wrapped in mink or saran, any way that you can, come back to me, come back to me, come back to me, come back to me.
And Frank Sinatra kills it. He does Yves Montand in the movie, even though he's a great French song singer, song interpreter, he can't sing Burton Lane.
No, he doesn't. English isn't his language.
No.
He can croon in
French. It's a great voice. You can hear every now and then the timbre of his voice, why he is not only a great actor, but a great singer in French cinema. But this is not his role.
No, he's no Frank Sinatra.
When Frank Sinatra sings Come Back to Me,
yeah.
It's got that really creepy line. One of it is draped in mink or saran, whatever you can, come back to me.
Yeah, what does that mean? Is that like alive or dead? Mink or saran?
Ooh,
I'll take you wearing a mink coat on my doorstep, or I'll take you in a body bag.
Ooh,
am I pushing too hard at this?
That's chilling.
Is it just a rhyme?
It's a rhyme, but it's also as fairly naked saran.
Okay.
Like just covered with saran wrap.
Okay, so it's like
right?
Some weird
like
sexual
plastic
fantasy.
Wrap.
Okay. That's slightly less creepy. Maybe the sexual fantasy and the body bag are one and the same. Who knows? Maybe this is just... Anyway, we don't have to delve too far down into the weird psychology of this character or Alan J. Lerner, who wrote the lyrics.
But while we're on songs, just because I want to talk... I think if we talk about On a Clear Day, we'll get to our thing. But want to talk about Love with All the Trimmings.
Yes, so, tell me what you love about Love with All the Trimmings.
So, number one, Barbara Streisand in Cecil Beaton gowns looks
fabulous.
Fabulous.
Well, and
she's
Beaton
wearing
turbans too. The turbans
and
are,
turbans. I was just gonna say turbans.
Turbans.
Oh, that was ESP.
Oh,
we're on
the same wavelength. We've done this podcast together in a previous life.
So. The Love with All the Trimmings is really her seduction of, I can't remember the dude's name.
Doesn't matter. Some blonde guy.
Well, the actor appears to me to be wearing a rug. I mean that.
The actor appears to me to have just walked off of a gay porn set. So I'm not sure that she's barking up the right tree there, but whatever.
So opulent scenes. And here's my point. The song, she isn't singing, she isn't lip syncing.
It's,
the song is in the background, underneath. And I think this is part of what led to her to Yentl, where similarly, it's a musical film, but most of the songs are sung in the interior of the person rather than they advance the plot, but they advance the plot by giving more information about the psychology of the people involved. And that's what Love and All with All the Trimmings does. I actually think it's a great little song melodically.
My dearest love, who existed in a dream till this evening, when a wave came and swept me out to sea. None of the loves that you have known could prepare you for the love raging everywhere in me. For all the arms that have covered you, the hands that have touched you, and the lips you have lingered on before, added together, would be less than an olive in the banquet of love I have in store. Love season to entice. Love with all the trimmings filled with spice. Love flavor to your whim. Serve piping hot with all the trimmings.
Talk about rabbit holes. I've listened to it a fair bit on kind of a loop.
Uh-huh.
It's got some interesting melodies. Burton Lane, whatever else you want to say about him, wrote some great tunes. Old Devil Moon, How Are Things in Glockamora, yeah. Come Back to Me, What Did He Have That I Don't Have? These are in the American Songbook classic. Love with All the Trimmings, I didn't know until I watched the film.
Mm-hmm. I think they wrote it for the film. I don't think it's in the stage show. I think they wrote it for
You're
Barbara.
You're probably right, yeah. It's perfect.
I'm not sure about that, but yeah.
And she also kills the first number as well. Hurry, It's Lovely Up Here, coaxing the flowers to grow. It's a great Barbara number.
I love with all the trimmings. I mean, this is the scene in the Brighton Pavilion. She's singing it under, you know, like that's the voiceover as she's in this fabulous Cecil Beaton turban and gown, sitting across the table from this blonde gay porn actor. And she has this glass of champagne and she kind of like rubs her face. They're like locked eyes with each other. The camera kind of goes back and forth between him watching her watching him. And she strokes the side of her cheek and then like pulls it down and like strokes her breasts with it.
I know.
And at one level, it's so shameless and so out there.
Yeah.
And so camp.
It's so camp.
It's so camp that it almost turns around 180 degrees and becomes brilliant.
Yeah.
But not quite. Also just so weird.
It is like, very weird.
Like, what are you doing, Barbara? It's just, it was one of the moments where I was like, this is kind of this film at its most distilled because it's really doing something that is kind of interesting, but trying way too hard. And it somehow it just like all of the elements don't quite cohere. And in that song in particular, it's like, oh, this could be a really, and she said in the autobiography, a lot of people have said that's their like, that's the sexiest moment in cinema to them. And I'm like, really? Like, okay, I'm sure. I don't, you know, who am I to.
And can we just say that Barbara looks fabulous?
She does. She looks amazing in this film.
Her skin is beautiful.
Yep,
she's dressed perfectly. She is sexy. I don't always think of her as sexy.
She is very sexy.
In that scene.
As Melinda. I mean, the Daisy Gamble, you know, the Daisy Gamble shtick. There is a kind of weird, it's very Gigi to me. Like, it's right next, you know, it's like, what is Alan J. Lerner's, there is a kind of hatred of that, you know, it's like, she can't begin a sentence correctly. I mean, it's basically kind of the hatred of upspeak, except it's not, you know, it's like, he's not faulting her for vocal fry, but he may as well be, right? Girls today don't know how to talk. Basically, that's his, right? Like, she's so empty-headed. So there's this weird kind of hatred of...
Why can't the English teach their children how to speak?
Yeah, a hatred of youthful femininity, and then also a weird kind of sexualization of little girls that lay right next to each other that I find deeply unsettling.
Yeah.
So the way that the film treats Daisy Gamble, I don't love. I actually kind of like the way Barbara plays her. She knows how to kind of do the Brooklyn girl shtick. I think she's pretty good at that.
She's but as Fanny Melinda, Bryce again, you know.
Yeah, she's kind of Fanny Bryce.
Yeah.
But as Melinda, now we should say her English accent is
terrible.
Not a success. It's a horrible accent. And then she tries to do Cockney in one scene. It's even worse. But her even her like upper class, like one of the reviews you sent me, I think it compares it to like faux Terrence Rattigan dialogue in a bad Margaret Leighton impression. And basically that's, I mean, like it's a kind of drag performance. She's doing a drag performance.
The accent comes and goes. I mean,
it comes and goes. It's very imperious. It is, to a certain degree, kind of sexy. I mean, there is something very interesting about seeing her as a 19th century courtesan. It's so bad, it almost works.
And as she says when she's Daisy, what is it about an English accent, right?
Yeah, right. Why does everybody follow themselves? I am Melinda. I mean, like, it's so absurd. But the performance is, I mean, it is, I don't know if it's good, it's fascinating. And she believes in this stuff, right? Like, Alan J. Lerner believes in this stuff, and Barbara believes in this stuff. She thinks that she can turn flowers different colors by the power of her mind. I don't think that she's, you know, like, I don't think that she's a devotee. She doesn't practice transcendental meditation. I don't think that she, you know, Alan J. Lerner is. He is into this stuff.
Yes.
He describes it as like his lifelong hobby. And then he's finally like, I guess I should do a musical about this, because he's done a ton of reading about it. He's really into hypnosis. He's into ESP, and he's into reincarnation. Those are like the cornerstones of his mental and past life regression.
Yeah.
Like all of that. He's a true believer. So there is a way in which On a Clear Day You Can See Forever is almost missionary propaganda.
Yeah.
I mean, it is endeavoring to convince us that this is, I mean, and maybe this is the time to talk about that title song.
There we
right?
go.
Because I think that's what On a Clear Day You Can See Forever, I think that's what Alan J. Lerner thinks it's about. It is a kind of reincarnation ESP New Age hymn.
On a clear day, rise and look around you, and you'll see who you are. On a clear day, how it will astound you that the
rise and look around you, and you'll see who you are on a clear day. How it will astound you that the glow of your being outshines every star.
You'll feel part of every mountain, sea, and shore.
You will hear from far and near a world you'd never heard before.
I mean, and there is a piece of me that, I mean, Barbara talks about having a moment like that when she goes on a Deepak Chopra retreat, I think. And like, you know, she's given her mantra and she meditates. And she says, like, I had a moment where I felt like the me that was me was dissolving into the, and she says, like, actually, I was kind of terrified. Like, I mean, I don't think it was a pleasant experience for her to feel part of every mountain, sea, and shore and feel from far and near a world she'd never heard before. I think it kind of freaked her out a little bit. But then she went back to her apartment and managed to mentally change the color of her flowers. So, I mean, in some ways, it's like, well, I guess it worked, right? Like, she is a believer. There's also a piece of me that's like, yeah, I recognize I mean, the one way that we could, on A Clear Day You Can See Forever, is like that is the experience of contemplation in the Christian mystical. Or that's one way that I could frame that, is a lot of the Christian mystical tradition, a lot of the Christian prayer tradition, a lot of Christian spiritual practice is about dissolving the ego and finding a way to access the kingdom of God, we might say, right? Like a place where I do feel part of every mountain, sea, and shore.
Well, then there's the whole theology that Richard Rohr and Ilya Delio, that I am very attracted to, which sees the human not as separate from the natural world, but part of the creation, part of every mountain, sea, and shore. And the conversation I think we had around Hello, Dolly, where we remembered, you know, your question to people who say, I don't believe in God. You say, when did your heart beat faster? When did tears come to your eyes? And folks almost always say it was music is one, but more often it is their experience of the natural world. It is seeing a sunset. It's being on a mountaintop. It's being at the shore and having the sense that there is more to this, which I think just by extension, understanding myself as part of this landscape rather than a objective observer within the landscape. You are part of every mountain, sea, and shore. And then I think as Christians, do we believe a world we've never known before?
I mean, isn't that just another way of you know, like Paul says, we are God's children now. What we are to be has not yet been revealed. I mean, like, isn't that just kind of central to the Christian theology, which is, I think there's been a lot of good work that's been done over the past, long time around kind of thinking about heaven, right? Like, maybe it's, and actually kind of going back to the New Testament and looking at the way that term gets used, it's probably not, it's certainly not only the place you go when you die. It is a reality that Jesus seems to believe has been brought into the world by his, you know, like the kingdom of God is with you now or among you or in
within
you, depending
you.
On how you or within you, depending on how you want to translate that. But it doesn't necessarily seem that he promulgated like paradise, pie in the sky when you die, so much as, oh, no, it is here on earth now. It is with us.
It is another dimension of reality. Right. There's another dimension of reality that we don't see every day, that's sort of beyond the space-time sensory universe that we think is reality. And I think Christians want to say, there's something more.
Yes.
There's something more here. Something deeper, higher, broader, more mysterious, less concrete, more intuitive. I think we say that. I'm thinking back, Marcus Borg, who has a great relationship with Trinity Cathedral in Portland, the late, great Marcus Borg theologian. He spoke to the clergy colleague group that you and I have been part of before you were part of it. And near the end of his presentation, he opened a conversation around these 15 or so rectors of large Episcopal Anglican churches in North America. And he said, what do you believe about the afterlife? And I think of that group, liberal, Anglican, Episcopalian, Christian clergy, more than half, I want to say three quarters of us said, if there's an afterlife, that's not essential to our theology. A quarter said, it's what it's all about. You know, we promise eternal life. People live good lives. They go to heaven. Most of us said we were agnostic.
Yeah.
About afterlife and even more personal consciousness within afterlife. Like, if there is life after death, are we aware of it? I mean, my own way of coming at it is we behold in the afterlife the beatific vision, right? And individual consciousness is so insignificant compared with the vision of God, that it's really not about a cosmic cocktail party where we go around and meet our dead relatives, you know, living now in heaven, and other famous people from history or anybody else. You know, I hope it's not like that, being an introvert. That would be hell for me.
I was going to say, that sounds like my worst nightmare. That might be hell.
But so I think within the progressive Christian world, the notion of an afterlife is lots of us are agnostic at best, if we're honest. Maybe you're clearer about this than I am. I don't mean to lump you in with progressives.
But I think it's, I'm heartened to hear that story. I'm so glad that Marcus asked you all that directly, because my sense is we don't have a, I don't have a lot of conversations with my colleagues about what we actually believe happens when we die. And I mean, I think that's a way of, like, so much of our work is helping people. So there's, I understand.
Helping people live and helping people die.
Helping people, because and really it's helping people grieve. Yeah. And you know as well as I do, like, you know, that's when those conversations come up, is when you're planning a funeral with somebody who's just lost a beloved. And it's like, that's not the place to explain theologically. You know, it's like, that's a place where I am very open to helping the person I'm with make meaning of their experience. So sometimes that, you know, I remember actually sitting with a young woman whose husband, you know, she was super young. She wasn't even 30. Her husband had committed suicide. Like, you know, like, and she was convinced that he had been reincarnated as their dog. Like, and she brought the dog with her to the appointment. She's like, and really, I mean, needed to get this. I mean, like, she was traumatized. She had discovered the body. She was dealing with intense trauma.
Yikes.
And this was, right? Like, she's like, basically what she needed me to tell her was that I also believed that her dead husband had been reincarnated as her dog. And in that moment, it was not my place to engage in a theological conversation about reincarnation, right? Like, she needed a pastor and she needed a friend. So most of my conversations around death have been in that context, right? So at one level, it's like, I am kind of agnostic from a pragmatic perspective. I am willing to entertain just about any idea if I can, if that's a piece that will help me help to make meaning in a conversation with somebody so that they, you know, like, are able to move into the next part of their life with a little bit more of a sense of connection.
And here's the thing. My experience is that when people are in grief, the deep immediate and maybe even into a year or two into their journey of grief, they are way more open to extrasensory things than they have been before. And I've had this experience myself in grieving where I had, it was after my dad died, which is, oh gosh, almost 30 years ago now, more than that. I had a experience of his presence. It was momentary. It was involuntary. It never happened again. But it was while I was in the midst of grief. It was very comforting. It was beautiful. If you asked me theologically to explain it now, 30 years later, I'd say, I believe I was closer to the presence of God where all eternity lives in a moment, in that moment. There was a breakthrough into the other sphere. I mean, I've often said, because people just like you have come to me in their grief as a pastor, and they start talking about their experiences of the beloved or their experiences at the deathbed. And I have said more than once, at the deathbed, you realize the veil between the worlds is very thin. And they go, yes, yes, it's very thin. And they've had an experience. Now, I'm not trying to get spooky and ESP, Alan J. Lerner-y about this, but I think he's on to something. I think he's on to something about spirituality and about how the temporal and the eternal intersect. And for me, it's a mystery, right? And I put it in the category. But when I say it's a mystery, am I copping out intellectually from my own experience, both personally and as a pastor? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Mystery is our code word for the thing that we dare not think too far down the road because we're worried where we might end up sometimes, I think.
I think so.
And that's a little how I feel. You know, it's like, at one level, there is a piece of me that is such a snarky asshole that I kind of, you know, it's like I do kind of want to rain on the Alan J. Lerner parade and be like, this is bullshit. There's also, I mean, to your point, there's also a piece of me, it's like, yeah, I've had some weird shit happen to me, you know? So it's like, I kind of, with you, it's like, I don't need to explain it. It tends to come in moments of profound emotional connection, grief, often. So those are tender places in me. They're tender places when I've been part of those conversations with other people. I feel like it's appropriate to say, maybe in that sense, calling something a mystery is another way of saying that's a very tender, personal, set of stuff. And let's not rain on people's parades. Let's not destroy how people are making meaning of some of the most horrible, difficult, beautiful, wonderful parts of being a human being. However people manage to make sense of all that, I think it's the church's job to support people in doing that, not right. rain on their parades with correct doctrine, appropriate right. dogma, scriptural proof passages. I mean, there is a kind, you know, there's a piece of it, it's like there is a kind of Orthodox Christianity that would say, you know, reincarnation doesn't really fit into our theological system. You know, we are bodies, and when the body goes, I mean, like, this is kind of the Jewish understanding, as I understand it, right? When you're dead, you're dead. Now, there's historic reasons why, right? Like, there's a lot of fear and frustration around idolatry and idol worship. So, like, there's a lot of stuff in there. But my, you know, kind of my off-the-book answer is that there's not really room in traditional Orthodox Christianity for reincarnation. And there's also a piece of me that's like, well, shit, like, there's, you know, like, religion changes. We're, you know, it's, who knows? We're playing around with stuff that is so hard to talk about and is so personal and is so tender. So keeping a healthy sort of openness, which I think is all Alan J. Lerner is asking of us, right? Like, just be open to stuff you don't understand.
It's surprising to me that we don't want to talk about it more, because it is the great mystery that we're all going to encounter, you know, like none of us get out of this thing alive, and all of us are going to have to go through the passage of death. In terms of the Jewish understanding, yeah, when you're dead, you're dead. And there's the Jewish wisdom tradition, you know, from the book Wisdom, the souls of the faithful are in the hand of God. And so there is a sense, no torment will ever touch them. I happened upon a documentary on Netflix about Ram Dass, R-A-M-D-A-S-S, you know, Ram Dass. He was a Harvard student who dropped acid, and then that led him on a spiritual quest. This documentary, it's about 45 minutes. I loved it. It's after he had a stroke, which he also sees as a spiritual awakening. And it's before he died, and he is being cared for. He's in a wheelchair. They get him into the ocean. They get him into pools. And he's narrating it. But he says three things at the end of it. Death is not an error. It's not a failure. It is taking off a tight shoe. Oh, death is taking off a tight shoe. It's the releasing of something that has been confined, right? Like when you take off a tight shoe and you can wiggle your toes again, you can move your foot again, you're all constrained in a tight shoe. Death is a tight shoe, so that when we die, it's like having, being liberated out of this body that we have. That's just so that rambled concept, around in my mind ever
no,
since I
saw
it.
No, I love that. I think that's really beautiful. So is reincarnation like just putting on a different shoe then, and like hope we find one that fits a little better this time?
Who wants to put on another shoe, right? You know,
I mean, if they're great shoes, like I'll put up with a tight shoe if I look fabulous in them. I went to a party the other night. I borrowed shoes from a friend. They pinched like hell, but by God, I felt so hot in those shoes. Like I kept them on longer than I probably needed to, and maybe did damage to my foot. I mean, I love the image. I also want to answer back. Like sometimes you put on a tight shoe for the sake of the party.
Sometimes. So, but how did it feel when you took the shoe off, Nathan?
Oh my God, it was so liberating. It was so great.
Well, that's what I love about the image of dying being unconfined, unrestricted, right? And I think that's what this is playing around with, I guess. And my problem with reincarnation, I mean, if it exists, it exists. I kind of hope not. I think once is enough. And what we're carrying around with us is a life that we lived before, and that is what the mystery of our unconscious is about, I think that's kind of limiting. I think the unconscious, which is random, crazy, unpredictable, is much more mysterious, and there's so much to be explored. Like, where do we go every night for 7-8 hours if we're lucky? in those dreams that are so vibrant to us when we first awake. We've been roaming around in this other world, right?
Just like Dr. Chabot, Molly, wandering around in Daisy Gamble's subconscious and discovering, oh my God, there's all kinds of... I mean, there is a piece of me that, like, he discovers there's all kinds of women inside of her.
Yes.
It's, I mean, there is, I don't know, yeah, that gets into some of the gender politics of this again.
Well, yeah, right? And I think that is Alan J. Lerner's way of working through feminism, right?
Yeah,
right. Women are deeper than Daisy. There are worlds within women. Men are not the imaginative ones, or whatever it was, that quote from The Atlantic.
Oh, God. We won't trot that one out again. It can be forgotten. But yeah, I think you're right. I think that is his way of navigating a species that he does not understand, needs, feels drawn to, but also I think hates at some level. I think that's a lot of his misogyny coming out. I also, like, you know, there is something really interesting to me in that image. You know, it's like there's one, I think it's come to me that kind of names it, right? Like, is maybe you'll come back a girl. You quoted me the line earlier.
Right. It's in Come Back to Me, as a girl or a boy.
As a girl or a boy, which opens the doorway then for the Broadway revival of On a Clear Day, where it's not a woman contains multiple women, but each of us contain multitudes, and gender becomes very fluid.
So in the revival, 2011 or whatever, Harry Connick Jr.
On
a Queer Day plays the psychologist. And the rather than Daisy, it's David, who's a gay florist, whose past life is a woman played by the great Jesse Mueller. And
a jazz torch singer or something like that.
I think it lasted 26 performances on Broadway.
Yeah.
It was universally panned. But I think it was then a kind of update, trying to take this artifact of 1960s and bringing it into a postmodern world, it still doesn't work.
Still doesn't quite work. But what an interesting idea, though, because I feel like if you're gonna take if reincarnation is gonna be your operating framework, it has to. I mean, it's a very narrow understanding to assume that every time you're gonna come back as a woman, right? Like,
And my
sense is, like, it's also kind of narrow to assume that every time you're going to come back as a human being, or even as, you know, it's like, that's where I think On a Clear Day, you'll feel part of every mountain, sea, and shore. It's like, yeah, that, I mean, that starts to make sense to me in a certain kind of way, that this whole, that life is way weirder and broader. So yeah, like, I'm probably not going to come back as another gay dude over and over again, like looking for my, you know, my one soulmate and have to find them in this life. Like, you know, I'm probably coming back as a grass next time. I hope I, you know, it's like that to me starts to make a little more sense of an expansive universe, not quite so much a human-centric or even sort of narcissistic.
Yeah. Well, that's
personalized.
That's the Hindu worldview, as I understand it. Now we're into karma, right? That you come back until you get it right, and there's kind of a working out of your salvation,
the cycle of suffering.
Which
is a little more. That's a little more theologically robust than Alan J. Lerner's kind of new agey version of reincarnation. And I think that's a piece of what I find frustrating about this material is trafficking actually in, you know, some religious systems that are thousands of years old with millions of adherents and developed systems of thought, and kind of treating them in a cheap sort of gimmicky way.
Yeah.
And I don't like it when films or musicals do that with Christianity, and I don't particularly like it when films do that with Hinduism and Buddhism either.
Exactly.
I find that a little disrespectful. And to a certain degree, a little appropriation-y in a weird. I mean, he's not attempting to do Orthodox Eastern religions, obviously, but I have questions about, like, I don't know, like, this is a very mid-century American male version of reincarnation. Like, of course, a powerful man writing in 1970 is going to sketch out this version of reincarnation. I find most of it kind of icky.
Yeah.
But what the tools that he's using, the kind of framework he's utilizing, I find fascinating. And it is right next door to the work that I do, right?
Yeah.
Thinking about death, thinking about grief, helping people make meaning of falling in love and losing their loved ones. That I feel like that is the work of pastors.
It's an artifact of 1960s culture. It's even though the film was released in 1970, it's still a 1960s artifact of alternate forms of religion that were emerging in the culture then. Church was still dominant for large numbers of people, but there was there were these other things going on around parapsychology, around ESP, around past life regression, what we'd call now New Age. It was already there, and I think Alan J. Lerner was playing around with that in a clumsy, ham-handed way.
Yeah. Or in a way that, I mean, I think he was also a little bit ahead of his time in some ways, right? He was kind of, you know, my sense is a lot of the seeds that he's planting here would extend, you know, so he's operating a little ahead of the curve, I think, in some ways. So we can be gentle. I can be charitable towards Alan J. Lerner and not be quite so dismissive of him and what he stands for.
And the song, the title song, recorded.
It's a great song.
At least in my research, I found, without looking too hard, 15 different covers of this. I think there are more. Barbara herself did it three times, recorded it three times. She kind of wanted to get identified with this song. Why not? It's a great song. She sings it well. It's so corny in the movie. Her last rendition of it, she sort of very awkwardly, cinematically ends up soaring around the sky while she sings it. Mm-hmm. It's just weird. But she sells the song, you know.
She sells it.
Everybody has done this. Sammy Davis Jr., Jerry Vale, Frank Sinatra, Johnny Mathis. But a really interesting one is the Peddlers, a 60s rock band, I guess, used apparently in Breaking Bad, which takes the song and reimagines it in a really interesting way.
Yeah, it's almost a gospel number. There's a sort of Hammond organ aspect to it that does make it kind of fun. So maybe that's the note to go out on. We'll end with the Peddlers singing "On a Clear Day You Can See Forever," huge in New Zealand apparently, and leave it there for now.
Until next time.
Until next time.
You'll feel part of every mountain, sea or shore, and you can hear from far and near a world you've never heard before. On that clear day, you can see forever and ever, ever more.
The Gospel of Musical Theater is a production of Trinity Episcopal Cathedral in Portland, Oregon. Join Peter and Nathan every other Friday right here in your podcast feed, and connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @GospelOfMT. Learn more and support us at trinity-episcopal.org/podcasts. See you next time!